Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict prays for courageous solutions to the conflict in the Middle East. Church leaders from around the world discuss relations with other Christian communities as the Pope creates 23 new cardinals. Bishops in Australia gather for their plenary assembly 2 days after electors choose a new Labour government. And remembering the life and legacy of the Reverend Chad Vara, founder of the Samaritans. Pope Benedict has called for prayers ahead of a crucial Middle East peace conference in the city of Annapolis in the United States this week. Speaking to the huge crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square following a consistory mass on Sunday morning, the Pope prayed that participants at the conference would find the necessary wisdom and courage to bring reconciliation to the war-torn region. His words came after he had placed a gold ring on the finger of 23 new cardinals, telling them they too must work to bring peace and unity to the church and to the world. My colleague Emma McCarthy has all the details.
Cari fratelli e sorelle.
From the great door of St. Peter's Basilica, Pope Benedict asked pilgrims to pray that participants at this week's Mideast Summit in Annapolis, Maryland, find the wisdom and courage necessary to bring peace to the Holy Land. Before reciting the Angelus prayer with the hundreds of faithful who withstood driving rain to witness him bestowing the rings of office on 23 cardinals, the Pope thanked them for their presence at the ceremony and asked them to join in the prayer launched by the United States Bishops' Conference for Peace in a region so dear to us.
Martedì prossimo, ad Annapolis, negli Stati Uniti, israeliani e palestinesi.
Washington is hoping that during this historic two-day summit, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will declare a formal resumption of peace talks in the presence of a large international audience. Pope Benedict said the meeting hoped to relaunch stalled negotiations to find a just and definitive solution to the conflict, which for 60 years has bloodied the Holy Land and provoked so many tears and suffering among two peoples.
Per tutti I protagonisti dell'importante incontro.
He then went on to thank the many pilgrims who had come from far afield in a show of support for the newly appointed cardinals who had joined him on the steps of the basilica to the delight of the crowd. Your presence, he told them, underlines the unity and universality of the Catholic Church.
I'm happy to greet all the English-speaking pilgrims who have come to attend the consistory, especially souls from Iraq, Ireland, India, Kenya, and the United States of America.
The Holy Father had made his way to the Basilica entrance at the end of celebrations marking the Feast of Christ the King and the second significant appointment of this week's consistory, the Mass of the Rings. During the Mass, the 23 prelates, dressed in gold vestments, formed a semicircle around the high altar, celebrating their first Mass as cardinals in union with the Pope.
Accipe annulum di manu Petri et noveris dilectione principis apostolorum dilectione tuum erga ecclesiam roparare.
Before the liturgy of the Eucharist to the tones of Exultate Deo, Pope Benedict bestowed a golden ring inscribed with the crucifixion on each cardinal, the final symbol of their unique bond with the Church of Rome, reciting the Latin formula, "Receive this ring from the hand of Peter, and know that with the love of the Prince of the Apostles, your love for the Church is strengthened."
Sull'anello cardinalizio è raffigurata proprio la crocifissione.
In his homily, the Pope told the cardinals that the ring will be a constant reminder to them of the King they serve, on which throne he was raised, and of how he was loyal to the very end, defeating sin and death with the strength of his divine mercy. The Mother Church, the Bride of Christ, he said, gifts you this symbol in memory of her spouse, who loved her and who gave himself up for her. Thus, by wearing the cardinal ring, you are constantly called to give your life for the Church.
Annunciare al mondo la verità di Cristo.
The Pope said it is a cardinal's particular duty to announce the truth of Christ to the world, hope for every man and for the entire human family. It is his primary mission to pray for peace and unity, so that the Church may be solid and compact, a sign and instrument of unity for all mankind. It is a truly great consolation, concluded Pope Benedict, that I can rely on you, collegially and singularly, to help me too carry out this fundamental duty of the Petrine ministry.
Let us give thanks to God for the gift of these new cardinals and strive to follow closely in the footsteps of Christ our King, bearing constant witness to his saving truths. I wish you all a pleasant stay in Rome and a blessed Sunday.
And my thanks to Emma McCarthy for that report. On Monday, the 23 new cardinals met together with Pope Benedict again in the Vatican, accompanied by delegations from their hometowns, the last event of these consistory celebrations. Their busy schedule here in the Vatican began last Friday, when the entire College of Cardinals met together privately with the Pope for a day of prayer and free discussions focused around the themes of collegiality and relations with other Christian communities. The discussions on ecumenism were introduced by the head of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper, who outlined three areas of progress and new challenges facing the Church. To find out more at the end of the morning session, I sat down with one of the participants, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor of Westminster.
I think, first of all, I'd say it was realistic. I would say that based on the Cardinal Kasper's fine, short speech, but a sort of resume of the three aspects of ecumenism with the Orthodox, with the other ecclesial communities, and with the Pentecostals. It was I thought it was very well laid out. And then there's what the interventions of the cardinals, and there were about 15 to 20 on different aspects of ecumenism, which varied from the Orthodox and with the other ecclesial communities, I suppose, for me, interest in the Anglicans, but also the other communities that have arisen from the Reformation and the Pentecostals. There were some cardinals also broadened it a bit. I mean, what did the ecumenical movement mean for contact with Jews, or even with other Christians, you know, looking at the dialogue with Muslims, which is not obviously the ecumenical movement in that sense. It's a interreligious dialogue, which is slightly different. But somehow or other, it was the Catholic Church looking at itself, its identity, and yet conscious that there is a need to continue the ecumenical dialogue and to present, yes, truth, but always in charity and in openness.
As you were mentioning, this sense of identity seems to be an increasing tension with the need to be open and honest towards our ecumenical partners. Did you feel that were any perhaps new ideas as to how to approach this?
There wasn't anything particularly new, except some people did talk about our Catholic identity. And it came up in the context that there was the beginnings, in fact, of quite developing fragmentation among the other churches and ecclesial communities, not only from the point of view of ecclesial communities with the Anglican communion, which is very clear, but also with others as well. So there's a sense of how do we use the God-given unity that we have. I'm thinking particularly of the Catholic Church's ecclesiology and sense of itself as church, and how do we use it to help the other Christians. However difficult or long the road is, we want to achieve full communion with them.
As you say, this fragmentation, though, makes the task a lot more difficult, doesn't it? It seems to be quite a bleak picture, perhaps.
Well, a number of them did talk about a certain pessimism, that a slight ecumenical gloom at the moment, because some of the high hopes of ecumenical dialogues haven't secured what the aim as quickly as people would have wanted. And there have been developments also that have made it more difficult. So I talk about ecumenical gloom, but also we're going back a number, and Holy Father mentioned this as well in this a few times he spoke, that ecumenism is also developing our relationship with Jesus Christ as Lord. The Trinity, the Incarnation, the Redemption, the focus on Jesus Christ. And the more we focus on him, the more we're, as it were, open to others. So I think that spiritual ecumenism has a new importance now.
There was also quite a lot of talk, I understand, of the new movements, the Pentecostals.
Well, the Pentecostals, yes, were mentioned quite a lot. And how can we, as it were, approach them? And because it's not the same as the more established church groups. And that has to be done really much more informally, I think, one or two were saying.
Can you tell us a bit more about, perhaps, the emerging dialogue with these groups that, until very recently, were simply described as the problem of the sects, weren't they?
Yes. I talk about a problem. I prefer using the word challenge to the Catholic Church, to see, well, how do we evangelize? How do we get to those people who, in fact, need to hear the word of God, need to hear the good news of Jesus Christ, when we have, inverted commas, in our view, such a more complete understanding of the mystery of Jesus than the Pentecostals have? So it is a challenge.
What do you see, perhaps, as the secret of their success in evangelization?
Their success is they go out to, what is it they offer people? A small community, a warmth, a support, a simplistic message, which many people look for. And I think the mystery, or rather the message of the Catholic Church is also, in one sense, simple and offers closeness and support and communio. Within the context of something much larger. We are very local in our local churches, communities, and also we're global because we belong to the worldwide Catholic Church.
What would you take away, perhaps, as a symbol of hope of this meeting?
Well, it was hopeful in the sense of the frankness of the way people spoke. The liberi interventi of the cards is very nice, and whatever the views that are expressed by different, just getting a view from, you know, from Africa, from America, from Europe, from Asia. I mean, it's something that hasn't happened in the same way, informal way, before, I think. And that's why I'm very glad that we have this opportunity.
And my thanks there to Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, head of the Bishops Conference of England and Wales. In Australia, the Catholic Bishops' Conference is holding its twice-yearly plenary assembly this week to discuss a variety of challenges facing the church there. The meeting in Sydney comes 2 days after Australia's federal elections that saw the opposition Labour Party defeat the Conservative Party of Prime Minister John Howard. In the run-up to the elections, the bishops released a statement on issues to be considered by the faithful when casting their vote. Father Brian Lucas is the Secretary-General of the Australian Bishops' Conference. He told my colleague Susie Hodges that the prelates urged Catholics not to forget the marginalised in Australian society and also stressed the importance of protecting the environment in the face of climate change.
Australia is a very affluent country. We're going through boom times thanks largely to commodities and the China-India situation, but there are people who are left behind in that, and so the bishops have reminded the Australian people not to neglect policies that will look after those people who, through disability, through mental illness, through circumstances of life, don't fully participate in the economic good times. The other area that's of some considerable interest globally is the question of environment, climate change. And again, Catholic Earth Care, which is the Bishops' Conference agency that investigates and researches and provides educational material in this area, has made comment about the need for government to be alert to strategies about that.
But what does the church see as the main challenges facing the new government after these elections? Father Brian Lucas again.
Well, I think the bishops would want that there be proper reform, but at the same time, a just workplace, so that the rights of workers and their opportunity for collective bargaining is respected. I think the bishops would want the government to stand up for the life issues, to be very conscious of the dignity of the human person. And one of the issues that is of significance in that area are the rights of Indigenous people. Unfortunately and tragically, the Australian Aboriginal people have been very severely disadvantaged in almost every aspect of life, in housing, in employment, in education, and most especially in health. The current government is making steps to try to redress that, but the strategies they're employing are not necessarily meeting with universal approval. But certainly the intention is correct to try to do something to redress the severe disadvantage of Indigenous Australians.
Turning to preparations for World Youth Day in Sydney in July 2008, are they proceeding on schedule given that the event is now only half a year away?
So far as I'm aware, and I'm not personally close to all of the actual detail of the arrangements, the organisers are quite pleased. There have been some difficulties with the Randwick Racecourse, where the final mass will be held, where there were some misunderstandings and upsets involving the horse trainers and their relationship with the government, and that seems to have been resolved with appropriate compensation arrangements. With 6 months to go, yes, there is an enormous amount of detailed planning underway, but all of the reports that I've had would suggest that that's moving forward quite successfully. We're in the very fortunate position, Susie, in Australia, that we've had quite a deal of experience. Now, this will be the fourth papal visit to Australia, and I remember having some involvement in the 95 visit, the 86 visit. The extraordinary capacity of our governments to handle protocol and security and transport. So the Australian temperament is pretty well geared to these big events and the organisation of them, and there's tremendous support coming to the church from both state and federal government and their agencies.
What about the World Youth Day Cross? Do you happen to know where it is at the moment?
Well, as a matter of fact, the World Youth Day Cross is in the Gold Coast, which is the tourist area slightly to the south of Brisbane in Queensland. And this week is what we call in Australia Schoolies Week. I'm not sure what the European or American equivalent of that would be, but at the end of the school year, which is about now, young people who are finishing their 12 years of schooling, 13 years of schooling, tend to go away to places like the Gold Coast, let their hair down and party for a week. And it began some years ago as just a small group of people. It's now captured the imagination, and there would be literally hundreds of thousands of school leavers congregating along the tourist area of the Gold Coast, and the World Youth Day Cross and Icon is visiting Schoolies Week this week.
And do you know what kind of itinerary it will be taking around Australia?
It's going to some extraordinary places. Those who've been organising it have taken it into prisons. They've taken it on warships across to the little islands. They've taken it to high places and low places. I understand there'll be some handover of the cross at the top of Mount Kosciuszko, Australia's highest mountain. And the two dioceses that more or less meet there, the Diocese of Wagga Wagga and the Diocese of Canberra and Goulburn, are making some arrangements for a handover of the cross at that particular point. What's been quite extraordinary, and this surprised the organisers and I think is very comforting, is the amount of publicity that the cross and icon are getting in the local newspapers. These are the local regional newspapers of the various towns where the cross is going. And it's extraordinarily positive and is certainly capturing the imagination of people with a very strong ecumenical flavour as well.
But aside from these activities in the run-up to World Youth Day in Sydney next summer, what do the bishops see as the priorities facing the Australian Catholic Church in today's secular society?
Well, I suppose that would be a question that each of the 44 bishops would probably answer a little differently. Obviously, the priority for the church in every age, in every place, is the need for evangelisation, the spreading of the gospel according to the circumstances of time and place. There are difficulties in doing that in the affluent Western world, and of course one of those issues that's very evident, partly connected with affluence and a comfortable lifestyle, is the question of priestly and religious vocations. So I think many bishops would see that as a significant challenge at the present time.
When you say you see that as a challenge, is that because there is a particularly acute shortage of vocations in Australia?
I think that's certainly recognised, and also vocations of a style that are not ideologically driven, that can meet the whole spectrum of the church's range of views, where priests and religious are able to relate across the spectrum of Catholic understanding.
Father Brian Lucas is Secretary General of the Australian Bishops' Conference, and he was talking there to my colleague Susie Hodges. Feeling depressed, lonely, unable to cope. The truth is that the vast majority of us do experience feelings of this kind at some point in our lives, even if we don't all end up contemplating suicide as a possible way out. Over the last year alone, however, more than 5 million people worldwide contacted the Samaritans, of whom over 500,000 did express suicidal feelings. The UK-based Samaritans Listening Service was started over half a century ago by an Anglican vicar, Reverend Chad Vara, who died earlier this month, aged 93. It was he who saw firsthand the need to provide some form of emotional support to people in despair who feel unable to talk to those closest to them. From a single black telephone in an inner London parish, he set up the world's first helpline, which has today grown into a worldwide organisation with branches in countries right across the globe.
He was an innovator, and he had just been appointed a curate in 1935 in St Giles's in Lincoln, when he officiated at the burial of a 13-year-old girl who had taken her own life, thinking she'd had a shameful venereal disease, when in fact she had just started menstruating and had her first period.
Dominic Rudd is chief executive of the Samaritans. He told me more about the origins of the organisation, currently run by tens of thousands of volunteers in over 40 countries worldwide.
He was so far ahead of his time because he had seen firsthand the effect of somebody not being able to understand just the basics of life, but more importantly, suffering from the barriers put up by the stigma around ignorance and shame. And his opportunity came in 1953 when he was appointed a vicar at St Stephen's in Walbrook in the City of London, where he set up a phone line, a single phone line, to give people who are suffering emotional distress and suicide feelings emotional support.
What kind of reactions did he have in those early days? As I said, he was touching on some areas which carried enormous stigma.
He was heavily criticised. He was breaking new ground. He was going against some existing taboos. But he was very clear-minded. He was very strong-willed. And what impressed me about him was his strong moral compass and his strong moral courage to know what was right, and was not afraid to speak his mind and to make the changes that have affected us all now in society.
As you say, the whole attitude towards suicide in particular, both in society but also in the church, have completely changed, haven't they, since then? I mean, do you think this was largely his doing?
Yes, he introduced two things. The helpline, that you could deal with these problems over the telephone, and we know now how many helplines we have in existence and how effective they are. But he discovered, but more importantly organised, he discovered the effectiveness of active listening, which is to be able to give people the space and time to explore their difficult feelings, to allow them to come up with the options for the future, and crucially to be non-judgmental and completely confidential.
Do you have any ideas, any statistics at all on how many people may have turned to the Samaritans over, well, more than half a century that he started this?
Well, it started from a few calls in 1953, and last year 5 million people picked up the phone to Samaritans. So it is just an enormous number of people seeking that quiet time, that period of calm, just to talk through their difficult times.
This is in countries all over the world.
It's in over 40 countries around the world. And the secret of the endurance of the organisation, secret of the endurance of his legacy, is that it's done by ordinary people. He's innovated by introducing the service by telephone, and that innovation continues now through email, through face-to-face, through letter, and in the United Kingdom and Republic of Ireland, we started offering the service in a pilot by text, and we're now exploring other methods using the internet. We've gone out to schools, we've gone out to workplaces to try and help people understand the issues people are facing, to give them coping skills, help them to become more resilient. But I'm especially proud of our work in prisons, where Samaritan volunteers train prisoners to give active listening support to their colleagues in prison. And this has had a dramatic effect on the emotional and the physical costs of distress in such an environment.
This is a real development, isn't it? I mean, you're dealing with, as you say, problems that are increasingly prevalent in society today. You're talking about suicides in jail, the phenomenon, for example, of bullying in schools, which can lead to children committing suicide. It would seem that some kind of training for these volunteers is necessary. What kind of preparation do they get to deal with these very complex issues?
The training is very thorough, and it is centred around non-judgmentalism. It's centred around confidence, confidentiality, and it's centred around building up people's existing skills in being able to listen and put everything in the context of the other person. It's nothing to do with yourself. So you need special people, but they're ordinary people. We all have it in us. So their training is very thorough, and it's centred around that non-judgmentalism.
I understand from the statistics that men or boys are two or three times more likely to consider or to commit suicide than women and girls. Do you continue research into these kind of statistics and to try and provide some answers as well as providing this very practical help?
Yes, we do. And we've just launched a research study into evaluating the effect of our service, Samaritan service, in the different ways that we deliver it. But it would be so nice to be able to say that the legacy Chad has left us has solved the problems. But I hear too many stories, too many harrowing stories of young people and old people and of all backgrounds just still feeling unable to seek help for their emotional distress because of the constraints that we in society put on certain behaviours, certain activities. We still live in a very judgmental and a very stigmatized society. And that's an indictment on us all. And that's why Chad Vara's legacy must be kept alive. It must thrive so that we can continue to change society.
My thanks there to Dominic Rudd, Chief Executive of the UK-based Samaritans.
And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.